The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Welcome back to the Keeper and Curry. It's Kip Keeper on the left-hand side. I'm Tony Curry on TKR, Tony Curry Radio. We do this show every single week. Two dudes know a lot about a lot of different things. Would you say we know a lot about a few things or a few things about a lot of
Tony,
things?
I know about I know a little bit about everything, but not very much about anything.
I don't know what the hell you just said, but it sounds good to me. All right, so occasionally I'll be trying to come up with some things to think about, to talk about here on the show. And we talked about politics last week. We talked about the inauguration. We talked about things. But normally the shows that I love to do most is when we talk about music. We talk about rock and roll because people don't realize just how in-depth and how well-steeped you are in music. You can recite poetry. You can recite lyrics. You can recite all these things. So I was getting ready to do a little television on Fox 6 today. For this thing called Music Mondays with Tony, right? Because I'm supposed to be the music guy, right?
Absolutely.
And so normally if I know I'm going to be on, I will, I end up not being on. I end up doing something with my kids. But normally I will look up this day in rock history just to see if anything was going on, right? So I wanted to share what happened because you could certainly make an argument. What was the day the music died, my friend?
It was the plane crash with Buddy Holly and Richie Valens, but I'm not sure what the date was.
All right, but we know that was the day the music died. I would say that in history, January 27th, which is the day we're recording the show, has got to be really close to that day, because I was sitting there, I was like, that's amazing that happened on this date in January. And then there's another thing. And I just kind of want to go through several things that happened on January 20th,
really
27th in rock and roll history. And I want to get your thoughts on them. Okay.
And I have no idea what's coming. So this is awesome.
I have no idea. On this date in 1956.
Okay.
You and I were not around yet. I wasn't born for another 10 years, but Elvis Presley's smash single Heartbreak Hotel was released by RCA Records.
Wow.
The musical wonderment about this is RCA Records had just purchased Elvis Presley's contract from Sun Records for $35,000.
$35,000.
$35,000.
I got that much in my pockets. Well, not exactly, but pretty close.
The single sold 300,000 copies in 48 hours.
That's inconceivable.
Can you imagine being the dude for Sun Records who made that deal? $35,000 Sun Records sold the rights to Elvis Presley. He comes out with Heartbreak Hotel.
And Tony, of all Elvis Presley's catalog, was there a more definitive Elvis Presley song than
"Since My Baby Left Me"? Oh, I found a new place to dwell.
What a fabulous song.
What a fantastic Perfect. Song.
You talk about a song that matched the artist. That was a match made in heaven. That is the prototype Elvis Presley song.
He would get his first gold record with that record. It was his first gold record of all time.
Wow.
Which I think was just amazing and a great song. And I remember I was about... You remember when they used to have these commercials on TV for albums? They used to have, Bobby Vinton had one. Remember all the song, Bobby Vinton, and they used to do the K-Tel albums, you know, the Dynamite.
The K-Tel. Like
that. I remember, and I still have it. I remember them doing Elvis Presley's greatest hits. And it was a two album set.
How about that?
Blue with a yellow outline on the back of it. And I remember ordering that thing, and I wore that thing out. It's one of the few albums I still have left down in the basement, but it's got every single that and Jailhouse Rock was one of my favorite.
That was the other one. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. 1958, January 27th, 2 years later, a guy named Little Richard left rock and roll and enrolled in Bible school at Oakwood College in Huntsville, Alabama.
How about that?
Richard later explained that while flying over the Philippines on a tour, the wing of his plane caught fire and his prayers that the flames go out were answered. So he decided to dedicate the rest of his life to God. Some of the members of his touring band found work with James Brown's famous Flames band during his 4 years in school. Richard still had hit records with previously recorded material like Good Golly Miss Molly. By the time he returned to music in 1962, now you remember Little Richard was like huge. I mean, he was bigger than Elvis. He was an absolute monster in the mid to late 50s. And you can make an argument without him and Chuck Berry, we don't have music, as we don't have the Rolling Stones, period. By the time he returned to music in 1962, do you know what happened? The British invasion had already started.
Mm-hmm.
And the best Richard could do was a minor UK hit called He Got What He Wanted in 1965. Jimi Hendrix actually backed him on a song called I Don't Know What You Got, But It's Got Me.
No kidding.
But the song barely cracked the top 100. So after Little Richard, and he was smoking hot. I mean, it'd be like Taylor Swift quitting music right now, right? Bigger than that. He goes to Bible school for 4 years. He comes back and he never had another hit again. No one wanted to have any until, and really, I don't think he ever had another hit. And really, no one even talked about his ass until, you know, we started seeing the guy wearing makeup stuff, you know, 10, 20 years later.
Oh, my gosh.
1962, Elvis Presley again received his 29th gold record. Now,
that's a pretty good run in 6 years.
I was just going to say, I guess I had to go back and look. I was like, wait a minute, 29th? Wait a minute, 1950s? In 6 years, he had 29 gold records. This one for Can't Help, I'm Falling in Love, just weeks after getting one for the soundtrack to his seventh movie called Blue Hawaii.
Yeah, the Elvis movies. Have you ever gone back and watched any of those in recent years, Tony? That they are so hokey and so ridiculous, but they were just huge.
They are so bad.
And they were really terrible.
And for the time, really risque. Really risque. I mean, if you go back and watch some of the stuff he says, where his eyes wander back in the 50s, I mean, really risque. It almost takes me back to Love American Style. I remember watching that show thinking, this is porn. This is porn. We're watching porn on network television, Love American Style. It was fantastic. 19, all these happened on January 27th.
Wow.
1968. Otis Redding Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Man, what a song.
Of course, it was released 6 weeks after he was killed in a plane crash. It would become the first posthumous number one single in rock and roll history.
How about that?
How about that? The first song, that's a piece of trivia you could win a drink at in a bar.
You're not kidding.
The first song ever to go number one posthumously was Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Otis had intended to return to the studio on a later date to add lyrics in place of the whistling sound that is heard during the closing bar.
Oh, that would have been tragic, because the whistling is, I think it's a great part of that song.
And he was going to add some lyrics. He just whistled. It was a placeholder until he decided to come back. And of course, he was killed in a plane crash. How about that action?
Yep. That's man. I need to look at, you know, I'm pretty much expert on most of the big, and there were so many of these guys killed in air accidents, because that was an era where you were rolling the dice if you got on any kind of aircraft, because it's not all automated like it is now, where a computer, if you had a guy who just had a bad day and made one mistake, you could be toast. Yeah. And so many, I mean, Tony, we could probably sit here and list, there's gotta be 40 or 50 major figures in rock music that died in plane crashes. It's astounding.
What's the number one? We should do this. We should do top five plane crashes. What's the number one plane crash for you for when it comes to celebrities? Is it Skinner? I mean, yeah, that's the first one I think of.
It's got to be. For me personally, the one with the most impact for me, because the circumstances are so tragic and unnecessary. When Jim Croce died in Louisiana, the only reason he was there, because a year before, when he was still kind of on the rise, he had gotten some kind of strep throat or some kind of disease or some kind of sickness, and had to cancel a gig in Natchitoches, Louisiana, just a small place, and he had gone viral in that year leading up to that, and took a small plane from Houston to this tiny airport to make good on a gig that he had had to cancel the year before, and flew in there and got on a plane at midnight to fly back so he could be in Houston for his gig the next night. And in climbing off that runway, apparently the pilot was unfamiliar with the terrain or whatever. They flew right into a bunch of trees and the plane exploded and he was killed. And that one always just kind of haunts me, because I love Jim Croce music and I love his whole style. This is a guy who was determined to make a big deal in the music business. He was going nowhere. He was absolutely in desperation. On Memorial Day weekend in whatever year it was, he sat down at his dining room table with a composition book like you used to get in college with the steel bands. He wrote 32 songs in a 3-day holiday weekend period, and 11 of them became major hits because he just made up his mind. I'm gonna go ahead and create material, and I'm gonna get this done. His story is not told anywhere near enough, and that plane crash to me is just one of the most tragic ever, because this is a guy who had just begun to really go to the top.
Yeah, how old was he when he passed? Do you remember?
Late 30s, I think. 38 or 39.
I'm gonna look that up right now. And I think you were the one that told me that. Isn't his cousin or someone on tour right now? Jim Croce was 30 years old.
Oh, it's only 30. Oh, yep. Wow. I was had he been the later 30 years old. Is that not just, I mean, dude, there's just no telling. I mean,
and his kind of music is like, the only thing I can think of is like Gordon Lightfoot type of music. His kind of music would be around forever. I mean,
it's still
around forever, but I mean, he's the kind of guy where, like, you want to talk about a Vegas show or something like that.
If he
was in his 60s. So
I got to see him twice live. And let me tell you, it was just great, because he was the kind of guy who he had the kind of fun songs. He could, you know, he had Leroy Brown and he had, other ones like that.
Big Bad Jim. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's the other one I was trying to think of. But he also had such unbelievably poignant lyric love songs. And, you know, that's what always gets me as the hapless, helpless romantic that I am. Jim Croce wrote some of the most beautiful lyrics from a guy that you look at him, you go, this guy produced this kind of lyric. It's unbelievable.
Message in a Bottle, Operator. I mean, we go on and on. By the way, he'd be 82. He'd still be alive.
No kidding.
Yeah.
30 years old. That is absolutely, it shakes me up every time I think about it.
You know what? We could, we need to do a show, but it's hard because when it's top of mind, I just love talking about it. You were talking about plane crashes. There's several that pop into my mind. You know what happened 5 years ago yesterday?
I do not.
Kobe Bryant went down.
Oh, of course. The helicopter. Crash. Oh, another.
That was 5 years ago yesterday. remember Donnie Allison? Donnie, Davey. I'm sorry. Davey
Allison. Yeah. With Red Farmer trying to land at Talladega with his helicopter.
Yeah. Didn't know how to fly a helicopter. And then, I there were several other ones, Steve Ray Vaughan. And I remember that's poignant because I brought him on stage. One of his last concerts that he ever did. I brought him on stage, and that was the helicopter that one Eric Clapton was supposed to also be on. And Stevie's like, I got this. You stay back. Blah 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 blah. I don't know if they were about ready to go to tour, because Steve Ray Vaughan was actually playing, and Joe Cocker was actually opening up for Steve Ray Vaughan. And so they were. It was just cheap. It was cheaper to take a helicopter. I don't know. Seems like a lot of these are helicopter crashes.
And you mentioned Skynyrd. Skynyrd was on a plane that shouldn't even been in the air. It was like a 40-year-old transport piece of garbage. But the way they crashed was they ran out of fuel, Tony. No.
They ran out of gas. And wasn't the weather nasty too? They ran out of flipping gas.
I mean, it's just unbelievable. How huge would Lynyrd Skynyrd had continued? They were, you talk about on the ascent and already at the promised land, that run of albums and hits they cranked out in that 4 or 5 year period. That was another show that I'm so grateful that a good friend of mine, Joe Lipham, said, we're going to see these guys. It's really not my kind of thing. I'm not really into that. And thank God he talked me into going, because it was one of the greatest shows I ever saw. And it was probably the spring of later on. I think it was in August when they had the plane crash. I saw them 4 or 5 months in Atlanta before that happened. And to this day, I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to do that.
To come full circle, we should make you and I should go see our buddy Damon go play lead guitar. I've yet to see him play.
Oh, I know.
Leonard Skinner. We know the lead guitarist, for God's sakes. And Leonard Skinner, I realize it's not the lead
guitarist. I went to Savannah last year, but was denied Nation.
I know.
And I also am good friends with Billy Gibbons, who I really wanted to reconnect with, and was. They wouldn't give me a credential for the show. So.
Life ain't over yet, my friend. We'll continue.
All right.
Listen, we're still in the 60s, man. We have just touched this date, January 27th.
Yeah, continue, because I keep taking you wrong directions.
In 1968, this band played their first American concert at Anaheim Convention Center in California after collecting their $50,000 fee. They had
50 grand.
They immediately headed back to England. Do you want to name the band? $50,000. Their first, they played one American concert and they flew right back to England in 1968.
Was it the Stones?
That would be the Bee Gees.
Oh, the Bee Gees.
Yeah. The Bee Gees getting $50,000 in cash. 1970, 2 years later, John Lennon writes, records, and mixes a song called Instant Karma during a 9-hour session. Yep. Man, that is a great song. And what I really realized too, 9-hour session, Phil Spector produced that record, which I had totally forgotten about.
Yep.
George Harrison was on guitar there. Billy Preston was on piano. Klaus Voormann was on the bass and Alan White on drums. And the single would go on to reach number 3 in America, number 5 in Great Britain. But yeah, he recorded that song Instant Karma in just about 9. Seemed like most of his songs, The Wheels Go Round. What was that song?
Yep.
Most of his songs that were huge hits. And it was funny because it's not a Christmas song, but the song Imagine can be played and used for so many different things. And I remember hearing that song over the holidays this past year. What an incredible song. You can make an argument that is one of the greatest songs, if not the greatest song of all time. Just it's forethought. When it was released, how you can play a song from the 70s and it could fit this one thing, and then all of a sudden it could fit something 50 years later. I mean, it's just amazing.
One of the great scenes in movie history was, of course, concocted, but the scene where John Lennon's involved with Dick Cavett and Forrest Gump comes out, and he's. You remember that, where Dick Cavett's asking about China? He's going, "Well, in China, they don't believe in God." And Lennon goes, "No religion?" And he goes, "And in China, they don't have nothing." And he goes, "No possessions, too?" I mean, that was just genius.
On this day, 1976, a 31-year-old Gary Glitter, you know him?
It remind me.
He goes, hey,
hey. Of course, being a sports fan, I've heard that gazillion times.
Now, Gary Glitter, who is often called the King of British Glam, announced he's retiring at 31 back in 1976. Now he's 31, right? And he's retiring. In 1976, although he has no intention of returning to the show business, financial pressures would soon force him to change his mind. I remember that song because my boss came in 1988 and he said at 5 o'clock every Friday, we're going to play this song. We're a classic rock station. And I was like, what is it? And I had never heard that song. I had never heard that song. And it's a lot of people call it the Hey song. What a lot of people don't realize is that song, Hey, that's called Rock and Roll Part 2.
I had no idea.
There's actually a Rock and Roll Part 1 that actually has lyrics with it. And then, of course, we love that song. We play that song. And then I want to say it was like 1998, 89, something like that. Gary Glitter, of course. They go into his home and they find child pornography up to the ceiling.
Oh, wow.
And because of that, you don't hear that song. You used to hear that song in stadiums all the time.
All the time.
People stop playing that song, much like they stop playing, what is it? Sweet Caroline stopped playing that because of the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
Touching me, touching you.
Yeah.
Yeah. 30, he would go on to retire. Could you imagine being 31, Gary Glitter retiring? Then of course he'd come back. All right. 1984. See, remember this one. This guy suffered scalp and neck burns when his hair caught on fire in an accidental explosion at the set of a Pepsi commercial shot in Los Angeles.
Michael Jackson.
That's it. Pepsi paid Jackson $1.5 million in a settlement, which he then donated to the Brotman Memorial Hospital, where he was treated. The commercial debuted on MTV on February 27, 1984, with the fire scene obviously edited out. Do you remember that when that happened?
I do. And I've also seen a great documentary on the war between Coca-Cola and Pepsi and how that was such a significant moment when the Pepsi people said, we got to do something. We've got to get market share against Coca-Cola, and they made the calculated decision to pay Michael Jackson at that time, Tony, an unprecedented $5 million to become the spokesperson for Pepsi and do those series of commercials.
Yep. And I remember thinking to myself, because at the time, I don't think anyone really thought it was a serious thing. And evidently it was like, it was really serious. Like, he almost got burned up to death. A lot of people were saying that maybe it had something to do with the fact that his face was changing color and this, that, and the other, had the pigmentation, the blah, 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 blah. I'm not sure if that was actually what the situation was.
It was very serious, though. I mean, it was
1991. Now that we have Super Bowl 59 set up. This would be Super Bowl 25. Whitney Houston sang the Star Spangled Banner.
And never ever was it more better delivered. That Whitney Houston to me had the billion-dollar voice. This, I mean, she could hit notes, she could go places that nobody'd ever been. And I tell you what, Tony, I get goosebumps when I listen to some Whitney's music to this day. And another, so many of these people just met ridiculously tragic ends that just did not need to happen.
Yeah, if you get a chance to see the Bobby Brown document, I think you and I maybe even talked about documentaries last week, the week before. It's 6 hours. Watch the whole thing. She was like a powder keg ready to go off. And he was, he was the spark. Bobby Brown did not bring her down. I mean, she wanted that type of life. She wanted the drugs. She wanted the crazy sex. She wanted, and if anything, I mean, she was the one waiting for him when he got out of prison. And he got out of prison for having all this coke and all this stuff. She had coke in the limo. And he's like, what are you doing? She's like, well, I knew you'd been so long since you've been partying and stuff, so I figured you'd want to really get after it. And he's telling the story. He gets in the car. He goes, we've got DEA. We got dogs. We got canine. We got everything. And you're coming to pick me up at prison. And you got a pound of cocaine in the back seat of the car. What the hell is wrong with you? And of course, he was trying to kick the habit. He was trying to get off the
stuff. Oh, yeah. You know?
He was trying to get away from it. And he knew that she was in trouble. But towards the end, I think there was a couple of videos where she had to sing on some TV, and she just, I mean, it was super sad. It was so sad. It's so sad.
Close to the end, maybe a couple of years before, they lived in a huge development in Atlanta called Country Club of the South, which is just a fantastic upscale neighborhood. And we frequented a restaurant in that area. Every Friday night, we went to a restaurant called Altobelli's, which was an Italian, it's a piano bar, but it's an Italian restaurant. A fabulous piano player named Randy plays there. And I was actually honored to be for about a year, one of the people that they would call to come up and sing a couple of songs with Randy's accompaniment.
Wow.
And it turned out that one night when I was there, the word was around in the restaurant, because this was like literally blocks from where Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown's house was, which later, you know, caught on fire in another famous incident that she probably started the fire. They never really have defined it. But anyway, I did my couple of songs. I did Billy Joel's song called a Ballad of Billy the Kid, which is not a big hit of his, but it was just a real fun piano song to sing. And I also did some other ones, but I did two numbers that night, and I was sitting there, and all of a sudden a guy comes up in a beautiful, like, $2,000 suit with dark glasses. It was Bobby Brown. I didn't recognize him, but he said, "Hey man," and he patted me on the back and said, "Really enjoyed your set."
Well, wow. You know,
and I said, "Well, thank you." And then later on, we see he and Whitney Houston apparently were sitting like way in the back of the restaurant. The rumor had been that they came there frequently, but she was wearing like a coat in the middle of the summer. She was like, had a thing, something covering her head. She was almost like she was completely in disguise. And he was kind of ushering her out with a couple of accompaniments guys. But Bobby Brown was, I mean, what a guy to come over. And I mean, he looked so visually impressive. You'd have thought he was a Wall Street guy or something.
Yeah. And looked the way she looked. It was one of the situations where it sounds like she was going to get into drugs with or without him. It was
sad.
It really is a situation where some people can take it, some people can't. And then Bobby
getting
Brown,
her start in a church choir is where she was discovered.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we should have seen it coming when
she talk about rebellion.
Isn't Dionne Warwick her aunt, correct?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And another incredible singing voice, which is fantastic.
The movie The Bodyguard, I thought was underrated. I thought she did a really good job as the diva performer in that movie. Kevin Costner was great, but the title song from that is the one she hits notes in I Will Always Love You that Man. I don't think anybody on earth could have hit.
No, she was the first Beyonce for me. I mean, she was the first Beyonce. She was the first Mariah Carey. I mean, she could hit notes where you're like, there's no way. Oh my gosh, she just hit that note. I cannot believe
phenomenal.
She was unbelievable.
Phenomenal. Yeah, that national anthem just soared. I mean, if that didn't make you proud to be an American, then you don't need to be in this country.
That was at Tampa Stadium.
It was
backed by the Florida Orchestra along with the music director Jaha Ling. It was performed by 73,813 fans watching, 115 million TV viewers in the United States, and a worldwide television audience of 750 million. I'm going to tell you something. I don't want to ruin this for you.
Okay.
But Jay Barker, who, of course, did radio with for 14 years, and his lovely bride, Sarah Evans, who's still doing the country music thing and everything, and they're doing fine. Thank you very much. He told me that she lip sank that song that night. And I said, it's impossible. And he goes, she lip sank that song, the Star Spangled Banner, 1991. And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah. And I said, I didn't know if that took any of the glare off. I don't know if I don't like that. I know a lot of people that do lip sing songs, but I've gone back and watched her sing. And it's so perfect. It's so on that if she did lip sync, it was the best lip syncing thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Cause I didn't get that sense. And I've seen the video, but I've never really scrutinized it in that way, but I'm going to now.
Yeah. Finally, on this date in 1998, James Brown was charged with possession of marijuana and unlawful use of a firearm after police were called to his South Carolina home. Brown later claimed that he was using drugs to help his eyesight. Well, there you go. It's glaucoma. You know, you got glaucoma. You know, sometimes marijuana is good for glaucoma. He was required to enter a 90-day drug treatment program. And for some reason, his eyesight got better. There you go. So just several things there on.
Unbelievable.
What a
significant date. That's amazing.
I do want to go. I got one more question I want to ask you before I let you go. Wow, it's already been 30 minutes. First of all, I want to do a show called I Can't Believe ... She's Dead or He's Dead. I want to do a show where several people have popped in my head and I was like, is he dead? Oh my gosh. That right. That's right. He's dead. It's like, I can't believe Tom Petty's dead. I just can't. It just happened so quickly. Like Prince. I can't believe Prince is dead. You hear the music. You're like, but I want to do a show. I can't believe ... is dead. And it could be anybody you want. I've got to get your thoughts because I know you're into politics. Is there any smoke to the Barack Obama, Jennifer Aniston fire? Is there any smoke at all to that? Is that a joke? Because people keep asking me to ask you.
Yeah.
And I think that if it was anyone else, if Barack Obama perhaps was white, maybe it'd be a little more believable because maybe the interracial thing is like, whoa, it's something. It's just one more thing that adds to the element of there's no possible way. But is there any possible way they're knocking boots?
You know, the smoke and fire thing is there's definitely some smoke there. And I tend to look at things that I don't know because I have, of course, no sources that would tell me if that's any validity, but I look at supporting evidence and everybody's assumed that Michelle Obama's refusal to show up at any of these events in Washington is anti-Trump venom. Maybe it's because she's not hanging out with Barack Obama because he's on the loose, on the prowl. Maybe there's some problems there. Everybody's just assuming this is some kind of political statement by her. But this is consistent when you don't accompany your husband to official functions that you're expected to just grin and bear it, even if it's not disagreeable to you. That tells me a little bit maybe that there's some trauma there. And on the other side, Jennifer Aniston has had a series of unsuccessful relationships, marriages, and is somebody that may be a likely suspect at this. I don't know. You could probably get her to age instantly here, but she's got to be in her 50s. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go ahead. Yeah. Continue.
So she's going to gravitate to the most luminary figure that's out there and is interested. So I don't think it's a really far-fetched thing. I don't have any evidence to the contrary, but I think it makes sense that these people would be attracted to each other.
Jennifer just turned 56.
That's what I mean.
She's going to turn 56. I'm sorry. Yeah. February 11th.
Yeah.
Wow.
It makes sense to me.
When I heard that, I was like, first of all, I was really surprised because I had heard the Jennifer Aniston thing, but I was really surprised when Michelle Obama, because she was the only one that wasn't there.
Yeah.
I mean, they almost dug up Jimmy Carter to put him up there.
To not show up for Trump's inauguration is one thing, but to not go to Jimmy Carter's funeral as a former first lady, that is just a gigantic slap in the face of everything that we hold.
There's nothing bigger. There's nothing bigger outside her having the flu or COVID or something. There's nothing bigger. There's nothing like, is there anything I can get out of this? Is there any way I can get out of this thing?
No, so when I heard the Aniston rumor, the aha light went off in my head of that's why she's not attending anything. She is not have anything to do with Barack right now because Barack is perhaps has left the building.
Jeez, man, that would be. And the funny thing is they both had ample opportunities to put the fire out, and neither one of them are doing it.
Yeah,
they're either playing us, they're having some fun with us, or there's something going on there.
I think there's something to it. I really do.
Damn.
Because a 56-year-old mega former celebrity like Jennifer Aniston is not going to be attracted to Joe Schmo, the cable guy, or even a relatively successful real estate developer. Jennifer Aniston at this point is going to aim as high as you can aim. And how much higher can you aim than a former president?
He's 63 years old. So it's not like,
The other thing
is, you know, I mean, I still think she is smoking hot. And I mean, I still watch. I she's on my television right now. I put Friends on. It's on TBS 22. It's my nap thing. It's just a happy. And the clothes, she's just so smoking hot. We always kept saying something's got to be wrong with her. Like something doesn't smell right. Something's wrong with her because she's had so many great opportunities. And for some reason, she may just be that girl with the snakes in her head. She may be crazy because, you know, the old picture of the naked, good looking woman and somewhere some guy's tired of putting up with her crap. So I don't know if that's the case, but you don't look like that and have that kind of money and not have your choice of whatever the hell you want. And maybe
that's right.
Maybe Barack Obama is what she wants. Maybe that's what that would be. A hell of a talk about a super couple.
Oh my goodness. Maybe that's why there's no real denial because they don't want to be tabbed as being dishonest or hurt their respective brand.
See, and I always thought Michelle Obama pretty hot too.
Yeah, if I don't know, I like kind of smaller women. I don't really Michelle's a little big boned for me.
Are you having a cup of coffee with Jill Biden?
With who?
Jill Biden.
If she didn't call herself Dr. Jill Biden, when she's got a teaching degree, I think I would be a little bit cooler with her. But I also don't like the fact that she was in on this scam of insisting her husband is on top of everything when it's the greatest fraud ever perpetrated on the American people. And if anybody's listened to me on your network in the last year and a half, I've told you how much BS that is from day one. If you're paying attention, you knew Joe was permanently out to lunch.
Now, on this pardon thing, real quick, on this pardon thing, it's for everything that's happened before, right? So you can't go out and do something now and be pardoned for, right? Or is this pardon for everything past and present and future? Or is it just pardon for stuff in the past?
It is preemptive pardon. That is not the spirit of what a pardon is supposed to be. A pardon is when you give somebody a break and excuse them from the incarceration or punishment of a misdeed. It is not a get out of jail free card, and it is not usually retroactive. The pardons he's given his family, and particularly his son Hunter and his brothers Frank and James, are basically dating back to 2014. Well, that's when the Biden fundraising efforts all began. Yeah. And to give a preemptive, you know, you can't indict these people, even if you've got compelling evidence. It is just heinous that he has done
well,
this.
Well, it sure as hell makes them look guilty as shit now, doesn't it?
Well, that's right.
What are you giving a pardon for? If they don't need a pardon, what are you getting now? Now, all of a sudden, it makes everyone look guilty. I if I had did nothing wrong, I'd say, Dad, thanks, but no thanks. I don't need this on me. I'm fine.
Since the family business was Joe Biden, mm-hmm. and access to Joe Biden and influence with Joe Biden, I always just can't believe, well, the Biden family business, they didn't have a product, Tony. They didn't have a service. They didn't have any expertise in anything. What they had was Joe Biden in the upper reaches of the United States government, eventually to be the president. That's what they sold. And Joe Biden's pardons of his family are de facto pardons of himself, because he wants to go back and live out the rest of his life in his twin multi-million dollar mansions in Delaware that he bought two mansions, two complete estates with cash on the second one in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, on the salary of, where do you come up with $3.5 million of cash when the highest salary you've made in the government is $185,000 a year?
That's some good Washington math is what that is.
You're not kidding. And we're not outraged as citizens when a Harry Reid in Nevada goes in after declaring bankruptcy 2 years before and serves 36 years in Washington and comes out with a net worth of $57 million.
I want those kind of numbers.
No kidding. I thought somebody had a great line the other day about one of our callers said, well, you know, I'm looking for a new job, but I'm holding that because I want one of those jobs where, like a college football coach, if you fail spectacularly, they give you $50 million to go away.
That's good stuff. All right, this is Kim Kiefer. I'm Tony Curry. It's the Kiefer and Curry Show. We'll do it again next week. And, of course, watch us on ABC 3340 for our starting lineup show. We do it every single week. And this week, we'll be getting ready for Super Bowl 59. Until next week, my friend. Thank you.
Tony, always a pleasure.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.